underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Jonathan Lethem is the New York Times bestselling author of 10 novels, including Dissident Gardens, The Portrait of Solitude, and Motherless Brooklyn, as well as several short story and essay collections. He has a pair of new books out, More Alive and Less Lonely, collects over a decade of Lethem's finest writing on writing, with new and previously unpublished material. He's also the co-editor of Shake It Up, which spotlights 50 landmark pieces by a supergroup of music writers on the rock revolution in all of its variety, from heavy metal to disco, punk to hip-hop. It is a great pleasure to welcome Jonathan Lethem to this week's Book Show.
Oh, thanks for having me here, and nice to be back.
Very nice to have you back on.
It's been a long time.
It certainly has. What is it that you enjoy? I know that you have also recently written a novel, but what is it that you enjoy about editing collections?
Well, okay. I mean, first thing I should say is I only edited one of these collections. The one that's full of my own writing was edited by Chris Boucher,
yes,
a novelist and professor in Boston who ever so kindly stepped forward and put this thing together. The other one, which is the book of music writing, a historical anthology of American, writing about rock and pop, I had a co-editor, my colleague here at Pomona College, Kevin Detmar. So in both cases, there was sort of like a secret weapon or a helper. That said, I do love putting together books. It's sort of like, a curatorial gesture. Maybe, I'm in a radio station right now. It's like being a DJ and putting together a great mix or for that matter, handing someone a really good mix tape, which is a sport that I used to be very, very keen on. But, in another sense, it goes to my roots in literature, which are those of a bookseller. I worked in used bookstores as a teenager and in my 20s, and it was really the only work I ever had before I started getting paid to write and then teach writing. And I love, I love putting good stuff in front of folks. It's about, sharing, really.
So let us talk about both of these books and begin with More Alive and Less Lonely. This is a collection that is culled from, say, two decades of reviews and anthology contributions and tributes. When you were working on these and in working with the editor, what ultimately did you want to achieve and have it represent from your body of work?
Yeah, well, so I had two previous collections of my essays. The first one, The Disappointment Artist, was really intimate. It was a sequence of essays about growing up. It was, really memoir writing. There were cultural occasions for some of them. I'd write about a Western film or a David Bowie movie or, different things gave me the excuse. But in every case, it sort of devolved to, Jonathan as a teenager and who was he and why did he have such a big crush on this, film or this book or this record. And then I put together this other really crazy, gigantic anthology called The Ecstasy of Influence, which was me as a, for want of a less pretentious term, as a public intellectual. It was essays on all sorts of things, contextualized with lots of writing about the occasions and, puzzling over the role of the novelist in culture. What that left uncollected were these, in a sense, much more direct and really my writing on writing, the introductions I'd written to other people's books and the reviews I'd written and, sometimes a reminiscence about knowing another writer. It's really a book of devotions. It's about, my life, doing what I love and in the company of other books and other writers, which is, how I've always preferred to think of it, not as a lonely, Promethean situation where you're sort of up on a mountaintop just handing down your own results, but that you're in a conversation.
It explained a lot, as you were talking just a moment ago, about the time spent in used bookstores, because there is such an eclectic quality to the writers and the books that you do write about in the collection.
Yeah, I'm all over the place. That's another way to put it. I have a tremendous promiscuous kind of enthusiasm for literature and genres and forms and writers. You know, there's a few canonical famous people in here, like Dickens and Kafka, who, you know, no one needs to explain why they're interesting or important, but I gave my own version of that. And, you know, I was just sort of lucky to be asked to write about them. But the preponderance of these pieces are a little more under the radar. Sometimes they're reviews of my contemporaries, more or less, someone like Laurie Moore, that I've been asked to, you know, say something about her newest book. A lot of them, and I think the defining stuff in the book is me as kind of, you know, the mole man digging a tunnel through forgotten corners of literature, helping rescue some out of print book that's being republished, or, you know, advocating for something, a minor work or a lesser known writer who I care especially for. And, you know, my interest is not so much in the contemporary landscape, but the idea that literature is a kind of permanently mysterious, entrancing, pile of stuff, and you can make your own canon. You can find what you like in it.
I was fascinated by an essay that you write that comes, I think, fairly early in the book, which is called The Greatest Animal Novelist of All Time, and was written as an introduction for Charles Dickens. It is a fascinating look at Dickens.
Well, you know, when you're asked to reintroduce a really, you know, towering writer like Dickens, and I haven't been in that situation too often. I guess I've done three or four like this for a series like The Modern Library, which is the instance here. What you're really being asked to do, I mean, no one needs to introduce Dickens except to say, hey, he's still good. And, you know, because the addition, you know, you're probably replacing some 30 or 40 or 50-year-old introduction that was commissioned to make him seem contemporary and interesting to a readership that's now itself, you know, historical. And so you're a younger writer, and the idea is to form a kind of bridge. You know, why does someone want to read Dickens now in 2008 or whenever it was that I wrote that piece? My feeling was Dickens is, you know, easy to take for granted and admire as kind of, okay, yes, he's canonical. Everything everyone's done subsequently depends in some ways upon his example and his innovations. But, oh, it's wearisome. It's like a college assignment or a high school assignment. And I wanted to say, here's how you could lose yourself in Dickens, and here's how you could rediscover the kind of sheer pleasure of his, you know, his generous, chaotic storytelling, which really is as fresh as the day it was written. And so I said, don't think of it as about human beings. Think of it as being like Wind in the Willows, about a bunch of really remarkable, bizarre kind of creatures, talking animals. And that was my hack to Dickens.
I think it is fascinating, of course, in seeing what you have done with and what you have written about various writers. I was thinking about this as I was going through the collection, though, wondering, because a lot of these are by invitation, I assume. People ask you to do these, to write introductions or to write meditations on certain people and their work. I wondered aloud as to what you say no to.
Meaning, oh, well, you know, yeah.
Meaning,
right.
Are
no,
there...
That's a great question. It's, you know, a book like this, it's really an alert question, because it's a track record of moments when I wasn't defending my boundary, essentially. You know, my goal is to always be writing novels. And I usually think that anything I'm asked to do is an opportunity to get derailed. And I usually try to say no. And most of the time I do say no. These are the irresistible things that either came along at the perfect moment when I thought, well, yeah, okay, I can, you know, I need a palate cleanser, or I'm actually stuck. I don't know what I'm doing right now. So yeah, I'll review this book. But more often, they're the things that, despite my intention to always keep my blinders on and just write the next chapter of my own work, someone said, you know, what do you think of Walter Tevis? And I think, oh my God, I love Walter Tevis. It's so great that you're republishing Walter Tevis. I've got to be involved in this. It's the stuff that I couldn't imagine not, you know, speaking up and being heard on. And there are lots of other things that, you know, that I have to say no to. I mean, I could probably, because I've made myself available this way and people think of me as an introducer or a writer of, you know, appreciations, I've done it so much. It's, you know, not to do the, like, the humble brag of how often people are tugging on my sleeve, but it's really compelling to me. You know, just the other day, I had to say no to a collection of the selected short stories of Robert Coover. And I'm actually really glad you asked, because it gives me a chance to say how much I love Robert Coover and his short stories especially. And someone's done, I actually didn't get so far as asking to look at the contents list, but they were doing sort of like his greatest hits, you know, 25 or 30 stories from across his career. And that, to me, that's a book that needs to exist. I'm really glad that it's happening. I just couldn't lend myself to it, you know, this week. But, you know, if I one day I ran out of gas and I didn't have any fiction left in me, I'd probably spend all my time I'd open a used bookstore is what I'd do. And I'd say, read this. And I, you know, if people kept asking, I'd keep writing introductions.
Jonathan Latham is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new collection is More Alive and Less Lonely on Books and Writers by Jonathan Latham. We also want to talk about another collection, Shake It Up, Great American Writing on Rock and Pop from Elvis to Jay-Z. This is edited by you and Kevin Detmar, as you mentioned. How did this particular project come about?
Well, this book was instigated by the Library of America, and with whom I had a relationship because I edited Philip K. Dick's novels for them. And so the folks over there, you know, in this really, it's a unique publishing program. It's a deliberate attempt to build the American canon, right? So, you know, when they began, their assignment was to, you know, make permanent editions of Henry James and Mark Twain and, you know, and Willa Cather and Faulkner and so forth. And they've done that, and they've got the kind of the American canon established. And then they began to expand this into stuff that was a little more contemporary, and in particular into making anthologies. And the real model for this book was Philip Lopate's absolutely brilliant and absorbing, remarkable compendium of American film criticism, mm-hmm. which he did for the Library of America. Maybe it's about 10 years ago now, which was a book I just adored. And so I got into a conversation with the folks at LOA about how there ought to be a corresponding volume that you know collects and puts the imprimatur of the Library of America on the great American rock critics and or music writers. You know, we can all think of some of the obvious examples: Lester Bangs or Ellen Willis, Chris Gow, Grill Marcus. Some of them still at it. The kind of the founding fathers and mothers of that field. But it's just a gigantic area, and there's been a tremendous amount that I find really compelling in it. So it was a slow forming project, and really the key was when Kevin Detmar got involved, he began to put together a kind of possible contents page. And then that, you know, that commenced like 5 years of push and pull debate, not just between me and Kevin, but Jeffrey O'Brien and Max Rudin over at the Library of America are, let's say they're not hands-off editors. They really got into it, and they both have strong opinions. Actually, Jeffrey's a very good music writer himself and is included in the book. And so they had pieces they cared about or wanted to speak for that I'd never come across as avidly as I read writers on music. I there were plenty of things that ended up in the book that were surprises to me that came from exploring and like I say, from this kind of happy argument that the four of us conducted.
When you say contents list, in this case, was it the writer's on the artists, or was it the artists themselves? In other words, do you come at it and say, well, we have to have something on Dylan?
You know, well, first of all, there's no difficulty getting something on Dylan. The difficulty was not having the whole book be about Dylan, because he's the
right.
most written about, he and the Beatles. What I would say is that clarifying that question was one of the first, you know, it was like clearing the area that we were going to work in. And one of the first things we realized was this was a book of writing and we wanted the writing to come first. We wanted there to be some kind of reasonable ratio of different kinds of music being written about. But that came along with looking for diversity and for the, you know, full breadth, the unexpected corners and, you know, different avenues of American music writing. But we wanted the writing to be its own reason for being. So if there was, you know, if let's say we were all fans of, you know, of the Beach Boys, and none of the pieces we found by the Beach Boys, about the Beach Boys, by the great rock writers or by obscure ones, really hit home or really stood up for us, we'd have to say, okay, they're not in the book. It wasn't about, you know, representation for the American musical tradition. It was about representation of a field of writing, a field of practice, you know, sometimes scholarly, sometimes fannish, sometimes, you know, iconoclastic or imaginative. But above all, we saw it as a written form in and of itself.
So you do end up with one by Jules Siegel, Goodbye Surfing, Hello God. Another way of asking the question that I asked before about the contents is, I assume that the writers also have their own beat, and with that comes a great, because they're also looking at all forms of music and different artists.
Well, you know, that's evolved. When you first see people sort of staking out this territory, Paul Williams, when he invents Crawdaddy magazine, and, you know, Jan Wenner with Rolling Stone, and other people with fanzines or early magazines, they're pretty much all talking about the same six or seven acts. You know, you've got a lot of writing about the Beatles and Dylan and the Stones, and, you know, or the Beach Boys, Jefferson Airplane. And then the field, the sense of what the terrain could be expands, and you get, you know, sometimes historical writers with a kind of a different emphasis. They're less talking about the 60s and the invention of the counterculture, and they're more talking about the deep roots of American music. Someone like Peter Guralnick, who goes and starts writing about Solomon Burke and James Brown and saying, hey, this stuff, you know, deserves scholarship and deserves writerly attention too. But all of these writers are making a claim that was in a vacuum initially, which was popular music of this kind, you know, was gonna reward and demand serious writing, because that wasn't a given. So the individual tastes and appetites of these writers creates a field, and then other people push it in other directions and widen it. By the time, you know, we come along as readers, we sort of take this this bold claim for granted. Oh yeah, if something is worth listening to, I want to know what these writers think of it. And you get someone like Chris Gow, who makes his job at the Village Voice being the kind of expansion of serious discourse to every area of what's on the radio, basically. It's like he just doesn't ever let anything fall out of his purview. It's like, you know, he's probably the first person to write some sort of serious critical piece, even if it's just a tiny little squib, about, you know, people like Ashford and Simpson, or, you know, stuff that was still just, you know, waiting to be written about.
You make this point in the book, and I think it's an interesting one, that as music evolved and these new genres came to light and into being, that the writing continues to change and extends the conversation from one genre to the other.
Yeah. It's really interesting to see also the trajectory of how writing about popular music has moved in a very, very, really compressed period through a kind of fannish phase where it was all being done passionately, and then it very rapidly professionalizes, and you have this period in the late 60s and especially the 70s, when there's a lot of money in, you know, sending journalists to follow a rock band around for a month and report it, you know, writing this big magazine piece about some band. And, you know, there are lots of glossy magazines that explode at a certain point. And then, you know, now we're in this period when it's moved into several different arenas. The magazine world has sort of collapsed. There isn't a lot of support and not a lot of people making their living writing about music for magazines, but there are these other avenues. It's moved into academia. You have, you know, a kind of a popular series like of short books like the 33 and a Third series. And there's a lot of writing online, obviously, which is almost like a full circle back to the fanzine world, you know, where people are doing it passionately and eccentrically and, you know, kind of staking out their own turf with no editorial pressure. It's different. It's different from the film reviewing that, you know, Lopate collected in his volume, because that is a relatively steady context. You know, people mm-hmm. decided that movies were worth reviewing and it was worth paying every newspaper or magazine to have a regular film reviewer. And once that was set up, it just sort of went on doing that forever. Music writing has gone through a lot of different kind of contextual reinventions.
As we wrap up, I'm interested, obviously, both books have in common the writing and the writers, but there is also the output of the literature and the music, and I'm interested in your thoughts on the intersection of those two.
Well, you know, what I love about writing is that it simultaneously, you know, reaches outside of itself and tries to make contact with the world and with other people. But it's also, you know, a field of aesthetics. It's a place where the sentences, the paragraphs, you know, it has formal properties. You become interested in what you're writing and it becomes self-referential and you know, you can make it meaningful on its own terms. And in either of these collections, you see the tension between those two goals. You know, like, are these reviews and introductions that I've written worth reading in and of themselves? I hope so. I mean, I hope each and every time I write anything, it develops some, you know, I apply some formal pressure, I locate some interesting characteristics in the voice and create a piece of writing in and of itself. But at the same time, these things are all basically blinking billboards pointing outside of the writing and saying, look over there, there's a record, there's a book, this is something you might like, you know, or there's a movie, or, you know, here's something that happened. And this is a permanent condition that can't be resolved. I think it just generates a lot of interest.
Jonathan Latham is our guest this week. The two books are More Alive and Less Lonely on Books and Writers, published by Melville House, and Shake It Up, Great American Writing on Rock and Pop from Elvis to Jay-Z, published by the Library of America. Jonathan Latham, it's a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us, as always.
Oh, it was a gas. Thanks so much for having me back.
Jonathan Latham has a pair of new books. More Alive and Less Lonely is his collection of writing on writing. He is also the co-editor of Shake It Up, which spotlights landmark music writing. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.